Unit 2, Part 4.
Hotel. The City Refuge. This refuge was started in the 19th century by Methodist missionaries in the East End of London. Traditionally, the East End has always been the poorest part of London, and the people who started this refuge went in aid of those who had no money and nowhere to sleep. The refuge still runs today on the same basis. There is no charge to stay there, and there is even tea and toast in the morning. The people who run the refuge, however, do not accept anyone who has been drinking alcohol or taking drugs. They will only take people who are in desperate need of somewhere to sleep. The problem they face, however, is that nowadays there are more people needing this accommodation than the refuge has room for. Long-term hotels. There are several streets around an area of London called King's Cross that only have this type of accommodation. They used to be for tourists who were on a budget and wanted to be centrally located. But this has now changed. King's Cross has turned into an area notorious for crime of all kinds, and tourists in particular are advised not to go there at all. Long-term hotels in this area are fairly cheap, due to the accommodation being very basic. A bed and a wash basin in the rooms with a shared bathroom. They are often dirty, damp, and dangerous. They seldom have proper fire precautions, and dealing in drugs is a common feature in these hotels. Not for the clean living visitor. The Bayswater Hotel. This area of London is a few minutes bus ride away from Hyde Park. The hotels here are reasonably priced, and the area is a safe one, which attracts many tourists. The Bayswater hotels are often large houses, which have been turned into small hotels. As a result, they have a warm, friendly atmosphere. The rooms, though small, are kept very clean and have that special English touch. The tea tray. This is to enable guests to make themselves a cup of tea or coffee at no extra charge. These hotels sometimes have a bar and restaurant which are reasonably priced and can be used by people who are not even staying in the hotel. Very often guests of the hotels have their breakfast and evening meal included in the price of the room. The YMCA. The Young Men's Christian Association has a very impressive complex in the heart of London's West End. Originally, the YMCA met together for religious studies, but it has now grown into a huge international organization. The YMCA in Tottenham Court Road has some of the best facilities in central London. It has a gym, squash courts, and a swimming pool. It is a long-term hotel, and many residents, both men and women, stay there for months, even years. The rooms are for single people. They are very comfortably furnished and all have their own bathroom. It may seem an expensive place to live, but if you want lots of things to do and want to meet lots of people in a safe, central environment, then this is for you. The Dorchester Hotel. The Dorchester, situated in the heart of London, is one of the most luxurious and expensive hotels in the world. A single night in one of their suites can cost you thousands of pounds. The services they offer are the best you can find, from serving you tea to driving you around London. The staff have a strict dress code and always wear a uniform. The Dorchester offers everything the lover of luxury could want, especially as it's provided in a very discreet, professional, and very friendly manner. This hotel is not for people who like the casual touch. The rooms are absolutely luxurious, with color televisions, jacuzzis, a fully stocked bar, fresh flowers and fruit. Definitely a hotel for people with taste and a large bank account.
Unit 3, Part 1. Tourism in the Czech Republic. A steady increase in tourism has resulted in prosperity and change in Prague. The Czech Republic is enjoying a tourist boom that has become increasingly important to the country's economy. In 1994, tourism accounted for £1.5 billion, which is expected to soon rise by 10%. Tourism, one of our top foreign exchange earners, is very important to the country, says Jiří Kek, director of the tourism department. 17 million tourists came to explore the various sites of Prague, known as the Golden City, in 1994, and the boom continues. Private business people have improved the Czech capital with new shops, restaurants, and cafes. Although plans to build a luxury hotel were opposed, the capital has attracted several of the world's leading hotel groups, including Hyatt, Hilton International, and Holiday Inn. These hotels bid for sites and contracts in the Czech capital. We are optimistic about the prospects in Prague, especially for conventions and meetings, says Daniel Durand, manager of the Prague Hilton Atrium, located near the city center. What makes Prague special, however, are small, friendly hotels like the Villa Vojta. This quiet and architecturally beautiful hotel, built in 1921, has become the first in the country to be accepted into the exclusive Small Luxury Hotels of the World Association. Foreign tourists are also beginning to discover attractions outside the capital, pouring cash directly into the farthest corners of the country. It is very important for us to expand the options available for visitors exploring the Czech countryside, observes Jiří Kek. The most popular site after Prague is the South Bohemian town of Český Krumlov, situated above the Austrian border. Its castle houses the oldest surviving Baroque theatre in the world, complete with stage sets, costumes, and a library of opera libretti. Thousands of such castles and chateaux, many in excellent condition, cover the Bohemian and Moravian landscapes, and many historic towns are renovating their ancient squares. Those looking for unspoilt nature can explore the Sumava region close to the Austrian and German borders, an area still rich in wildlife. The Czech Tourism Department is trying to encourage greater investment in facilities outside Prague to try to lessen the strain on the already crowded capital. What the minister would like most is an even spread of tourism across the whole country rather than the concentration on Prague. Indeed, the city is finding it difficult to cope with the tourists in terms of accommodation, transportation, and the sewage system. For me, the perfect world would be to have nature lovers wandering the Bohemian hills or hiking in the Sudeten Mountains, and culture seekers visiting the castles of Moravia before a stop in the musical city of Prague, says Mr. Keck. There are many destinations to explore in the Czech Republic, which is busy restoring pre-war greatness. Whether the country gets full benefit from the still growing influx of tourists depends on how successful it is in offering more facilities while preserving its old world atmosphere. Unit 3, Part 2. A rainy day can be a blessing in disguise, was the judgment of one of the organizers of this year's Sweet Chestnut Fair in the tiny French village where I live. Because of almost uninterrupted rain, only about 10,000 people turned up. Had it been sunny, there would have been total traffic chaos. Some visitors came out of curiosity. The fair is only 5 years old. For others, it has become an annual journey down memory lane. Until fairly recently, the chestnut was a central part of the diet here in Châtaigneraie, literally the chestnut grove. The air was fragrant with the smell of roasting chestnuts, at least until the downpour soaked the grill. There were stands selling cakes made with chestnut flour and open sandwiches of mashed chestnuts, cheese, and bacon. There were also articles made of chestnut wood, such as baskets, furniture, and walking sticks. One of the highlights of the fair was a cookery competition for original recipes incorporating chestnuts. The president of the panel of judges was the chef Michel Bras, who owns the best restaurant in the region. Bras has written a massive cookbook of inventive recipes, many of which call for the wild plants and mushrooms he comes across as he goes on his daily jog. People packed into the village hall as the competition started, partly because they wanted to see the famous bar, and partly because it was pouring down outside. The crowd watched calmly as the judges sampled mouthfuls of seven dishes and gave them marks for appearance, taste, balance, and so on. The winning recipe was a delicious charlotte of chestnut puree and cream, served with a bitter orange sauce. At that point, the audience, already deeply frustrated at not being allowed to taste the dishes themselves, stared in amazement as Bras made a harsh summing-up speech. "I couldn't find the taste or texture of the chestnuts of my youth," he said, before running off to his car. There was a jollier atmosphere at the Aligot evening. Aligot is a local dish consisting of cheese, mashed potatoes, cream, butter, and garlic. A huge iron pot of the kind used for cooking pig food was carried in. Three well-built young men stirred the mixture vigorously with what looked like canoe paddles. Then, to cheers from the 340 diners, they announced it was ready. An hour later, after everyone had eaten their aligot, made from 145 kilos of potatoes, 42 kilos of cheese, 12 liters of cream and 4 kilos of butter, the waltzing began. It was a proper village dance, where anyone was free to invite anyone else for a spin round the floor. Unit 3. Part 3. Weather from the West by Colin Luckhurst. For many years, I used to think that the national interest in weather was as much a British obsession as the state of their lives was a French one. But I've realized it's not really like that. When other subjects could be controversial, embarrassing, or too personal, the British prefer to resort to unimportant observations. "Rather cold today, isn't it?" they say. In these damp and misty offshore islands, the weather and its comparative unpredictability is quite an interesting subject. Tony Target, our regional television weather presenter, showed me around. He is, like other forecasters, actually an employee of the meteorological office. Doing the televised forecast, although a high-profile activity, is only part of the work of those employed by the Met Office. A wide variety of people have a serious interest in the weather, and will pay for an early insight. It's not just the obvious ones, like the National Rivers Authority, which can usefully learn about rainfall, but the police, the highway authorities, the airports, and also some less likely groups. The power generators and the fuel industries take advice on expected temperatures, which dictate demand, and, for the gas industry, the need for storage capacity. I was intrigued by the range of information inputs which provide the basis of the forecast from the Bristol Weather Centre. There are other satellites, either orbiting the Earth or in a fixed position. Weather stations, wireless operators on ships in the Atlantic, radar, which shows exactly where the rain is, and computer modelling add to the flow of information. At the Met Office, we were able to look at readings from weather stations in eastern Canada and the United States. There, it was the middle of the night. We watched as the computer graphic zoomed into a weather station in Vermont to take a reading of temperature, cloud cover, and wind direction. Most of the British weather comes from the west, so knowing what is happening on the eastern seaboard of North America will often prove relevant more than 24 hours later. But the Met Office is pleased to say they are 85% accurate in their forecasts. I have observed that when the local authorities in Boston forecast rain, it really does rain. The reason is, of course, that on the coastal edge of a populated continent, the weather systems have been recorded by information points for some time, and so accuracy is to be expected. Unit 3, Part 4. Inventions. Hideaway is safe on a coat hanger. Stowaway is a great new security idea. A fully portable travel safe that doubles as a coat hanger. Put your valuables inside, lock it firmly to the wardrobe rail, then hang up your coat or jacket on it. Its main purpose is hidden by the clothes. But if a thief should take a closer look, he'll find Stowaway is securely locked in place. Ideal for use in hotels, sports changing rooms, and at home too. There is plenty of space for your passports, tickets, money, checkbook, and several items of jewelry. Two keys supplied. Stowaway. £24.99. New one-step tooth whitening system. Developed by an American dentist and made in Britain, Dental White is the effective way to whiten stained and discolored teeth. Unlike other products, the effect is achieved in one simple process. The system comes with applicator trays for upper and lower teeth. When heated, the trays mold to the exact shape of your teeth. Now, squeeze a thin line of whitening gel into the tray and bite into it. The results can be dramatic, especially with yellow tea stains. Complies with European safety standards. Dental White, 250 gram kit, £9.99. The cleanest sweep of all. Now you only need one broom to cope with every cleaning chore, indoors or out. Carpets, vinyl and wood floors, patios, the garden, and the driveway. Incredibly, the Wonder Broom will sweep, clean, and rake them all. Made of durable rubber and fibers that are completely washable, it will even remove the finest particles like pet hair, salt, and sugar, but won't damage furniture or surfaces. You can use it as a mop on tiles, windows, and on the car. Yet it's also perfect for raking outdoors. And in normal use, it will last a lifetime. This really is a cleaning revolution. Guaranteed for 10 years. Wonder Broom, £16.99. A golf driving range in your back garden. The ingenious golf trainer lets you work on your game wherever you've got room to swing a club. And no more broken windows, lost balls, or trips to the driving range. It consists of a regulation-sized ball suspended from a hardened steel arm with a virtually unbreakable nylon cord. When you drive the ball, its rotation around the arm precisely indicates the direction of the shot, helping you correct your aim. Every golfer should have one. The Golf Swing Trainer comes with a lifetime guarantee. £37.50. Micromix stirs while it cooks. This beautifully simple British invention stirs food while it cooks in the microwave. Perfect for dishes like scrambled eggs, sauces, porridge, or custard. The Micromix stirring action not only keeps the food at the right consistency, but also eliminates health concerns over uneven heating. Better still, it prevents hot spots, which reduces the likelihood of boiling over and means you don't need to cover the dish. Why not get on with something else while the Micromix does the stirring for you? Fits all microwave ovens with a turntable. Micromix, £6.99. Unit 4. Part 1. Europe's trees in danger. Forestry experts have called on the European Union to use its powers in order to protect the continent's woodlands. This follows the publication of a recent report showing that one quarter of Europe's trees showed signs of severe damage. The experts are asking for wide-ranging action, as it now seems clear that Europe's forests are reaching crisis point. The study examined trees across the whole of Europe and found that they were being damaged throughout the continent. 26% of Europe's trees had lost significant numbers of leaves, while more than 10% showed signs of discoloration. The report also put forward factors such as air pollution and climate change as causes of this environmental problem. Responding to the report, however, a European spokesman said it was too early to be certain about what was causing the widespread damage. The European Commission has now begun a more detailed 20-year study, which will hopefully produce clearer answers. Francis O'Sullivan, Senior Forestry Officer at the World Wildlife Fund for Nature, WWF, pointed out, "While Europe is quick to condemn tropical countries over their forestry policies, it has been ignoring the crisis in its own backyard. Europe now has fewer forests than any other continent except Antarctica, and has less protected woodland than any other region in the world. Less than 1% of our ancient forests remain," he added. "If this is allowed to continue, the damage to our forest systems will result in a reduction in water quality and will cause a crisis in the fishing, tourist, and timber industries, as well as threatening the ecological balance in Europe." Nigel Dudley, a specialist forestry advisor, says that the forestry industry has made substantial progress in organizing a program of forest management. But, in his opinion, European governments have not been acting quickly enough. Dudley believes that there is a need for further European action on commitments made at the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. Next month, the WWF will be reporting on how well governments around the world have kept their Rio Summit promises. Most governments are expected to get poor reports. The situation in Europe may, however, be about to improve, as the European Parliament is to begin investigating forest protection and may ask for new safeguards to protect the health of Europe's trees. Unit 4. Part 2.
Half a mile from home, at the far edge of the woods, where the land was highest, a great pine tree stood. The top of this ancient tree towered above all the others and made it visible for miles and miles. Sylvia had always believed that whoever climbed to the top of it could see the ocean. Now she thought of the tree with a new excitement. Why, if she climbed at dawn, would she not be able to see the whole world and discover where the white heron flew and find its hidden nest? What an adventure! As she lay awake in her bed, she thought of the glory and triumph of telling everyone the secret of where the heron hid. Sylvia knew her mother and her guest were fast asleep, so she crept out of the house and followed the path through the woods. The air was filled with the sleepy songs of half-awakened birds. There was the huge tree, seeming to sleep in the fading moonlight. Sylvia bravely began to climb, the blood racing through her veins, her bare hands and feet gripping the bark. First, she had to climb the oak tree that grew alongside. Sylvia felt her way easily. She had often climbed there before, and knew that higher up, one of the oak's upper branches rubbed against the pine trunk. When she reached it, the way was harder than she had thought. The sharp twigs scratched her, and the sticky pine sap made her little fingers clumsy and stiff. The tree seemed to grow taller as she climbed, and she began to doubt if she could reach her goal before dawn. But Sylvia passed the last thorny branch, her face shining with triumph as she stood at the very top, weak and shaking with exhaustion. There was the sea, dazzling in the first morning light. Two hawks flew east, so far below her, she felt she too might fly away among the clouds. The birds sang louder and louder until the sun came up. This beauty almost overwhelmed little Sylvia, but she did not forget her mission. Where was the white heron? She looked down to the green marsh where she had seen him before. There he was, rising and sweeping towards the great pine tree. He landed, and Sylvia froze as she watched the heron, perched two branches below, calling to his mate, cleaning his feathers for the new day.